Welcome to the Corporate Venturing Insider Series, where I interview top practitioners in the CVC world and learn with you the best practices and golden nuggets that they have accumulated over their careers. This week, you will be hearing a conversation I had with Thomas Hellman, Professor of Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the University of Oxford. Thomas, could you take a few minutes to share your story and how you got to where you are today?
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. So let's start with, how did you get interested about entrepreneurship and venture capital and any type of investors?
It was a very unexpected journey. I was through and through an academic. I was a doctoral student, and I was fortunate to be at Stanford University. This was basically in the early 90s. I chose Stanford over Harvard because the shadows on the photos were shorter, so there was more sun, and I didn't know anything about tech. And during my thesis, I met two very inspirational professors. One of them was Joseph Stiglitz, who went on to get the Nobel Prize in Economics. And then I had a second advisor who was really inspirational. It's the late Professor Masahiko Aoki, who was actually a thought leader in Japan, and turned academic and firmly believed that academics have a place in the real world to think about the bigger picture and also the institutions that underlie the economy. And so at the time, I wanted to write a thesis about Japanese banks because everybody was talking about Japan and how their banking system was special. And in a moment of brilliance, this wonderful Japanese professor basically said, Thomas, maybe it's a little challenging for you to really understand what's happening in Japan. But why don't you look around at what's happening here in Silicon Valley? Because it's kind of interesting. And basically, he gave me the tip, why don't you study venture capital? Something interesting is going on. And this was at a time when Silicon Valley was very different from today. I think that's really important. It was in the formative stages. It was still nowhere near the level of publicity and frankly, wealth. And frankly, I was very lucky. I was basically among the first generation of scholars that took venture capital serious.
Which year was it?
This was early 90s, 92 or thereabouts. That
92 would be Intel Capital was 1 year old.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes, yes. We had Andy Grove teaching at the business school. I saw him in the 90s, fascinating, very visionary leader.
That is amazing. Okay, I'm glad I asked the question. Wow. Okay, thank you. Now, again, in 91, Intel Capital started, so it was really formative. You were close enough to Intel to understand some of what was happening. What do you remember of Intel Capital as a corporate VC in the early stages? Because I read that the head of the CVC was reporting directly to Andy Grove. So there was something very direct to the strategy building.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the time I met once with Les Valdez, who was running Intel Capital. He was extremely aware of this and really wanted to bring in the next generation of corporate venture capital. I mean, since then we've seen two or three more iterations on what corporate venture capital is. But I think he was very thoughtful in defining what a strategic objective is and what it isn't and what it can and what it cannot achieve. And I think one of the challenges at the time was that corporate venture capital had a bad name in the entrepreneurial community. That were basically large companies taking advantage of entrepreneurs, and any smart entrepreneur would run away from them. In the case of Intel, the main issue was, let's sell as many chips as possible, let people adopt computers, and anything that supports the greater use of a computing platform was a strategic complement, what I call a strategic complement. So in that sense, Intel had a relatively easy game, an easier game actually than Apple, Microsoft, and some of the others. But for Intel, it didn't really matter exactly what people do, just use more computers and therefore buy more of our chips. And I mean, Les obviously understood that, but I think it also meant that Intel had a good shot, but did very well for a long time.
They are in the news right now because they have announced they are going to spin off from Intel and they are going to change their name. And I think they invested, I want to say, more than $2 billion and 2,000 companies. And for them to 34 years later, spinning off is quite big in corporate venturing, as you can imagine. Actually, let me ask the question. Would you have predicted they would have had such a long run as a CVC?
No. No. In fact, the worry with CVC is always that it's the baby of the current CEO and changes with the next. So no, I think the Intel was remarkable for at least the first decade. They were the leading example of how to do corporate venture capital, right?
I mean, I've learned a lot from them and from many members of Intel Capital. They are one of the best CVCs we know, and they've done really well. I think I just said 2 billion, but it's 20 billion investments they've made.
I was actually wondering.
An order of magnitude wrong. So, but now I want to move to the story about Apple CVC, because no one knows about Apple CVC story.
Yeah, I mean, I actually discovered it more or less by accident. And I actually wrote up a small case study. It's still available on the Stanford case series. But it was a fascinating story that gets precisely at this tension of how much do the corporate venture capitalists pursue a corporate strategy versus trying to attract entrepreneurs and focusing on making themselves attractive to the entrepreneurial community. And basically, this is, I think, around 84 or thereabouts. Apple decided that there was so much opportunity and that it wanted to grow and it wanted to have a corporate venture capital division. And when it started, it basically did a little bit of research and very quickly found out that corporate venture capital has a bad name and that entrepreneurs don't want to work with them because there's a conflict of interest and they pursue their own corporate goals at the detriment of the entrepreneurs. And so when Apple set up this venture capital fund, it said, we're not going to make that mistake. And they set up a venture capital unit, essentially. I mean, it wasn't an independent fund, but they said, we're going to give you a lot of investment independence. We want you to make the best investments. We want you to behave like a venture capitalist. And we're not going to emphasize strategic returns. And we're going to measure you on IRR. We just want you to make really good deals and we want you to get deep into the venture capital community. And so they set this up and gave them quite a bit of leeway. And then they started making investments and I think it was like the third or fourth deal that they looked at was a complicated deal. And it wasn't a straight venture capital investment. And they ended up buying a small company. And the company was doing a number of products and it was all a mess. And they said, well, we're not going to look at strategic interest of Apple. We're going to think what is best, where is the highest value of these assets? And they decided that the company needed to be split in two. And one of them became Claris. It's not super well known, but it was a subsidiary, wholly owned subsidiary of Apple. And the other thing that really didn't fit in was this weird product that was called PowerPoint. And they didn't know what to do with this thing. And they just sold it to the highest bidder, who was Microsoft. And so Apple had control over PowerPoint, sold it to Microsoft to help them complete this Microsoft suite. And for the next decade, Apple struggled. So it was a monumental strategic mistake. Whoa. But it was the mandate of the venture capital arm.
I know, but this is do no harm. And here it's do harm to your mothership.
Yeah, I mean, the mothership bought into the strategy until they realized this isn't working. To make the long story short, the venture capital did extremely well. It had, I don't remember the exact numbers, they're in the case, but I believe they had IRRs over 80%. So this beats top decile VC returns. So these were good venture capital investments, great returns. Yeah. And the board just cut it after 5 years. They said, this is ridiculous. We're making 80% IRR on tiny sums of money. and we're giving away things like PowerPoint, where the strategic value is 100 times whatever IRR we're making on a small amount. I think it has really two really important lessons. I mean, first is you can't go all the way. You can't pretend as a corporate that you're just running a venture capital fund. You have to be thoughtful about the strategic objectives, but without them, it's just not worth it. And the other one is just orders of magnitude that Apple, I mean, this is the 80s, Apple was growing very fast, but I don't remember the exact amounts, but say it was 20 million and then you make an 80% IRR on it. It's still a rounding error for the size of investments that Apple corporate was looking at. And so I think this order of magnitude is really nicely illustrated with the Apple case study.
Okay. You work in Oxford, so I have to ask, and you mentioned that there was no VC in Europe or nearly nothing at the time. Clearly, that has developed quite well. Actually, I shouldn't say well. It has grown quite a bit, but there's a lot of challenge for VCs in Europe to do well today. And part of what I read on LinkedIn, so you will have to challenge me if I'm saying something wrong, is the way governments become LPs and create requirements on investments is creating dynamics which are not helpful neither for the entrepreneurs nor for the investors.
I think that's mostly rubbish. And it probably comes from America because the Americans continue to maintain that the government played no role in the venture capital industry, which means they don't understand their own history. The government has been, and in some ways still continues to be, an incredible important component for the venture capital industry. There would be no Silicon Valley if it wasn't for the Department of Defense. I did a worldwide study of the role of government venture capital, and we analyzed a whole bunch of data. And the main conclusion was that the performance of companies backed by government venture capital is only lower if the government entities are the only investors, but is actually higher than your private market when there is syndication between government-led and private-led investors. That's the key finding, and I absolutely believe that's still very relevant. A good colleague and friend of mine, Josh Lerner, wrote a famous book called The Boulevard of Broken Dreams, in which he basically brings sort of this notion that governments are just in the way. And for the venture capital industry. I mean, on the other extreme, Mariano Mazzucato wrote the exact opposite book, arguing that the state-led innovation. I have a doctoral student who actually wrote a thoughtful thesis about this, in which he looks at the development of the European venture capital industry. And I think you're going to love this one. But I mean, he basically comes to the conclusion that probably the biggest success story of government support for venture capital is France. But BPI France has been an essential part of how France has developed the tech sector. BPI France is very unique. My student actually traced the history of it, and there were a lot of political risks. But that has a very clear mandate, a national mandate, to develop a venture capital industry. And the beauty about BPI France is they really sort of have this sort of supply chain or value chain approach where they're going from very early stage to late stage. They're not doing what Mariano Mazzucato recommends, which is sectoral policies. They're saying we're supporting an ecosystem, and they're quite industry agnostic. Now, the principles by which the European venture capital industry was developed, by and large, are the principles of the European Investment Fund, the EIF, which is obviously coming out of the EIB. And it's always been market-led. So this notion that it's government or market is just wrong. It's wrong in the US, but it certainly doesn't work in Europe. And I do think that there is a maturation. There's a need that these support institutions, which are meant initially as catalysts, eventually withdraw and develop a market that has much less government in it. The key point, though, I mean, and I think it's just worth reemphasizing, is that there was a mandate by the government to support the ecosystems, but there was fundamental principle of working with the market and of being essentially non-interventionist. That's to say, unlike what everybody knows about or thinks about France as dirigisme and industrial policy, the support of the venture capital industry wasn't. One of the really interesting early subtleties in this is that a lot of the messages, in fact, a lot of the sort of consultants and actually you know, people coming from the US and telling you how to do it, they always said you have to go for high tech. And the French reformulated it as high growth. And today, one of the things that really encourages me, and this is something that I just see in my own work, is that there is a young generation that wants to become venture capitalist, that wants to either pursue the entrepreneurial path, or if they're pursuing the finance path, veer towards the venture side as opposed to the traditional investment banking side. And they're finding ways and new models of investing in startups that differs in subtle ways from the American model. Still has a lot to learn from the American model, no doubt. And any venture capitalist, I always say, try to spend, you know, some time, whatever time you can in the US and learn as much as you can. But I think the biggest credit, the biggest challenge is the US model is based on a unicorn logic. And we're trying very hard to do this in Europe. And it's not wrong. The unicorn model increases the ambition. It increases the awareness of competition. But you can make very good returns in a portfolio in which you have a lot of good investments and no unicorn. I think that's very relevant in the corporate venture capital world. I'm sure you've had many people discussing these issues. The reason I am somewhat optimistic is I think that if you think of venture capital just as a returns distribution, everybody talks about the right tail. Sorry, that's on my right tail here. I don't know how it shows up on the screen. But we love the success stories in the right tail. But there are parts of the middle distribution. If we just move this thing by 5 digit points or 10 digit points, we can create very good returns. Remember, there were now periods, there were years where the European venture capital industry had higher returns than the American venture capital industry. But it's no longer true, which it was true for the first 20 years, that the returns in Europe were just clearly worse. That's no longer true. Mm-hmm. So the way we build the returns is a little bit more in the middle of the distribution. I'm therefore optimistic. I do think the issue that you brought up about the government isn't going to go away, at least not for the next decade, in the sense that the economic interest in Europe is still very important. I think this is an economic necessity, so we can't afford to let the venture capital industry die. But I do think that by the time you sort of get to a second generation of European venture capitalists, you're building such a level of expertise and so much more refined, detailed thinking that we're not just trying to do what the guys in Sequoia are doing in the US and then realizing it doesn't work, that this new generation is figuring out new ways, often subtle changes in the way that they finance companies that makes this a viable investment.
Which makes more polished, more disciplined investors.
Yes, yes. Now, I mean, I think one of the really difficult questions is the geography of that within Europe.
Yes.
And I mean, basically, when we started, it was nothing. And I do worry that sort of this desire to make venture capital available for everybody is not going to work. It is an industry that needs to be concentrated. It needs these ecosystem effects. And so I worry a lot about the main hubs doing well. And if we start with London, Paris, Berlin, that's not a bad start, but they really have to function. And if Lille doesn't function, then that's just the economic reality. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite statistics comes out of the Atomico report every year, the state of tech in Europe. The graph in the Atomico report has something really interesting because they call it the flywheel. I pay attention to this flywheel and the fact that the flywheel is accelerating. What that means is the flywheel is basically what falls out of a good startup is serial founders, employees who become founders. And this what the graph or the anatomical graph shows is that the flywheel is accelerating. So when it took maybe 20 or 10 years to generate 1,000 founders coming out of successful startups, it now only takes 5 years to generate 1,000 founders. Mm-hmm. So basically, I think the way I think about ecosystems is in terms of these generations. If you have a first generation, there's amazing heroes, but there are a few, they're isolated, and they have really hard experiences. And they pass on their wisdom and say, this is how it works in Berlin, or this is how you can do it in Paris. And then they pass that knowledge on to the second generation, and then even to a third generation. And that's when we have a real ecosystem. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic about these European centers, because we're now having these second generations.
So my own belief of why the US venture capital works so well, especially in the Silicon Valley, is a paying forward mindset, where you're helping others with no agenda to get something back. What you just described is a paying forward mindset being applied in Europe more and more. That gives me reasons to believe Europe is going in the right directions to get more entrepreneurs with better coaches, better examples, learning faster, so the cycle goes faster. So I think that's how I'm taking what you just said.
Yeah, no, and I mean, frankly, it actually brings up a number of issues that are very close to my heart and things that we're also really trying to help with at Oxford. I mean, just the availability of entrepreneurship education. Now, you did mention coaching, mentoring. I think that's very important. And we have some experiences, and these are things that we're trying to give to our students, including at Oxford and beyond.
I think there is one more thing about the paying forward, which I think is very different in Europe, is you have your Rolodex and this is your assets, your contact list, and you don't want to share it unless you get something. I go to Silicon Valley and you start exposing an idea and people say, oh, I could introduce you to A, B, and C. Let's try, let's check. And there's no intentions to get any value from it beyond helping someone. So the paying forward is beyond coaching, mentoring, but also helping introduce to the right people. It's hard to believe unless you're there and you see it. And because you were based in the Bay Area, you had first-hand experience, but this is really special.
Yeah, I would agree. Profound.
I like it. And so I'm going to give... First, you mentioned Lille earlier. I'm from Lille, so I'm going to mention...
Oh, you're serious? That was the area. Yeah, I'm just picking a random city.
What is nice is I'm part of a guest lecture at Stanford for people who come from Lille, entrepreneurs from Lille, and they come to Stanford for a week. And it's funny because they all ask me, why should we take VC money? And my answer is very provocative. I say, please don't take VC money unless you really want to become a very big company, very successful. But taking VC money comes with a level of pressure, of discipline, of expectations that many of you may not want to have. And I want you to comment on this, because I think entrepreneurs dream about the stories that you see in movies where you take VC money and you're big. How much of that is true for most people, for most entrepreneurs? And when is it the right thing for an entrepreneur to want to take VC money?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are lots of nuances, but a good friend is Noam Wasserman, who's written The Founder's Dilemma. It's a good book. What Noam is trying to say is you do have choices to face as an entrepreneur. And if you want to scale, you're going to lose control. So you give up your kingdom, but it can lead to what he calls the risk strategy. And I actually think that the key is scale. So do you want to scale or control is the way I will just rephrase it. So there are many countries where you should never lose control, because the moment you lose control, you basically get just kicked out. And the governance doesn't work, but it does work in the US. You can step down from the company and you still get a fair return and you still maybe have a role in the company. The answer may depend on your personal preferences. It may depend on the ecosystem and the culture that you're in. But scalable companies have many attractive features, and chances are you won't scale the way you want, but nothing wrong with setting up the ground conditions so you have a scalable company that if it works well, you can actually scale. I just think people have to understand what they're doing, and it's definitely not every venture, and there are many ventures that shouldn't go or just are wasting their time going the VC route. The other thing that a lot of founders don't realize, I think timing really matters. There are these inflection points, they're hard to define, but we intuitively know them and say they coincide with a Series A or a Series B round. So let me just take Series B. I think it's one thing for a founder to say, oh, I'm going to lose control. Or it's another to say to see, I'm going to lose control at Series B. What the majority of founders don't enjoy life after Series B. It's a very, very different life than what you were doing at seed stage, right? And I think giving that perspective is to say, no, maybe there's a time where you've put your imprint, you've created an organization, you imbued your values, you imbued your vision, and now let it go.
So you've given a few golden nuggets, but this is the biggest golden nugget, I think, for anyone who's listening, entrepreneurs and even investors, on how to frame that kind of discussion. Because
yeah.
Entrepreneurs love the 0 to 1. 1 to 10 can be fun, but this is very different already. The 10 to 100, 1,000, this is different job. This is operational. This is repeat. This is very different. This is not necessarily what got excited from the 0 to 1.
Yeah. So interestingly enough, at the university, I often spend more time or have more access to founders who've just sold their company. That's when you have more time to go and talk to a university professor or teach a little class. I talk to a lot of people who've just exited their investments and they're thriving. They're absolutely thriving. They're saying, for 7 years, my life was crazy. I loved it. And now I've sold this thing and I can go back into the cycle. I can have fresh ideas. I can explore. I can do the crazy things that I'm really good at. So I think that is a very healthy cycle.
Wow. Thank you, Thomas. This was an amazing conversation.
I did not mean to offend the people of Lille. It was literally a random name that came to me.
And so that the audience know, Lille is a beautiful city in France, and the people are so nice. And I recommend everyone to not just visit Paris if you go to France, but also visit Lille.
Very good. That you did very well. And since my hometown is Brussels, I say stop by in Lille and then come to Brussels.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you. Very much. Pleasure.